Listen. Midnight. The witching hour.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Magical Musings. I'm your host, Brian. We're here with Joy tonight.
Hey again.
And tonight, we are celebrating Samhain, or Halloween. Got some interesting stuff to talk about tonight. We're going to be covering the history of Samhain and the early days of Halloween over the course of the past several centuries, and you know, we'll finish off the night with a bit of a guided visualization and shape-shifting experience. Hopefully it works for you.
Imagine a show where we talk about the topic.
We'll see. We can always say we will, but you know how that works.
Never goes that
way. We always tell ourselves we're going to. So, folks, I guess tonight what we're going to do is start off by acknowledging the fact that little intro thing that you guys heard was kind of a chuckle to the stereotypes of Halloween, because I personally have no issue with the green faced hag kind of thing. I personally like them, but then, you know, considering they come from like the Wizard of Oz and that sort of thing, it doesn't bother me.
Wicked, you know, having a green faced hag is not a bad thing anymore.
That's true. And actually I read the book Wicked, and that was interesting, I have to say. I guess what we'll do is we'll start with the sort of basic concepts that are the foundations of what became Samhain and Halloween. What happened, you know, in ancient days, before, you know, the advent of the internet and TV and books, for that matter, you're dealing with a time period in which, you know, lifetimes were shorter. You know, the average person might have lived to see 40, and that would have been considered old. You know, it was a time when disease ran rampant and nobody understood the causes of that or how to heal them very well. So, you know, lifespans were shorter. Even when you had kids, you know, the idea of having numerous children wasn't really as much a population growth thing as it was playing the odds, hoping that you had some kids to survive. Now,
plus free farmhands, you know.
Well, naturally. I mean, what else are kids for? Kids are for slave labor. That's just what they're for. And they all know it. We all did. Now, even speaking of farmhands, in the advent of agriculture and herding and that sort of thing, you'd be dealing with kind of a seasonal period where you would go through abundance during the harvest, you know, like during the time when your vegetables were ripe and growing, and, you know, later into the year when you'd have, you know, your fruit. It's more common in like North America to see it, even nowadays, where you've got like apple trees ripening sort of in the late summer. And, you know, into the fall, you've got like grapes and things like that. But come the time around Samhain, you know, late October, you would be preparing for kind of the winter months to come, because there was no refrigeration, and because you had to maintain a supply of food that could sustain the herd that you did keep over the course of the winter, because otherwise feeding all these animals would cost you a lot more, and you needed the money or the food supplies to feed your family. So Samhain would be a time when you would slaughter your animals and preserve the meat. And that's why you see traditions of feasting that come up around this time. You know, you're dealing with the idea of like Thanksgiving and Samhain and, you know, all these kind of things. They're all times when people would celebrate the abundance of food because they just slaughtered these animals in preparation for winter. So,
And Samhain is the last of three different harvest fests. I mean, you've got Lusnada, which is the first one. Then you've got the next one, the solstice, which is the end of the summer. And then, you know, now, which is the last of the harvest festivals, because you're getting in the late crops and you're getting the beds ready for winter. And like, you know, Brian said, the herds are bedding down and you're preserving the meat and everything like that. So this is when all of the celebrating the bounty of the earth would really happen.
definitely. And actually, they've found kind of remains in digs around Stonehenge that suggest that, you know, there were times of the year when feasting would happen, and the predominant food in those days would have been pork. Whereas, you know, in the Middle East, you've got rules that say you can't eat pork. I mean, across Northern Europe and the British Isles, pork was a very common food. And it's typically associated with, you know, Samhain for some reason. I believe mostly in Ireland. So until I became vegetarian, I used to celebrate every year with a pork roast, you know, mixed with like apples and, you know, root vegetables and stuff. And in the Henge of Keltry, actually, they have this little rite that connects to, and a character in Irish mythology. Joy, do you happen to know who that was? Because I can't recall.
That would be Pwyll, Gwydion, who decided that his cousin Gilvathwe was in love with the footholder of Math, son of Mathonwe, whose geese was that his feet had to be held in the lap of a virgin unless he was at war. And Gilvathwe was in love with her and wanted to have her. So Gwydion caused a number of bards and he to go to Pwyll's court and steal a whole bunch of pigs from Pwyll that were gifts from Anwen, and start a war so that Gilvathwe could have sex with the lady he was in love with. That's the short story.
Very complicated sort of situation, but that's not surprising with Celtic mythology. Now, there's, I mean, a lot of other cultures that you're familiar with, you as in the listeners, are familiar with mass media, the movies, and even through a book like The Halloween Tree by Ray Bradbury. A lot of people are familiar with the mummies in ancient Egypt. If you've read The Halloween Tree, you're also familiar with the tradition among the Egyptians of bringing out, you know, their ancestors to join them for a meal. It wasn't at the same time of year as Samhain. I believe it was more like summerish. But the idea of having feasts for the dead is something that's celebrated all over the world. Now, what happens go ahead.
No, it's just I was going to mention that some type of celebration for those that were deceased seems to be pretty much part of every culture. I mean, you have Samhain in the Celts. You have the Day of the Dead in Mexico, which is the remnant of an Aztecan celebration that's going to be taking place over the next couple days here on November 1st and 2nd. You've got the Obon dance in Shinto, and I'm sure I'm forgetting all kinds of other cultures, but I'm sure if you actually look, there's, you know, a common theme of thanking the ancestors for giving birth to the people that were needed to give birth to you.
It's true.
So that's the general type of theme as far as I can tell.
And actually that's an interesting point because it does explain the idea with in modern paganism there's something called the Wheel of the Year. Now, the two opposite festivals on that wheel, the two opposite spokes on said wheel are May Day, or Beltane, and Samhain, which represent kind of fertility festivals, periods of heightened magical power. You've got things like, Walpurgisnacht connected to May Day, or to Beltane. And you've got, obviously, the traditions that are associated with Halloween. And in each case, you've got stories of what was called the Wild Hunt, when troops of dead, you know, soldiers, basically, would be thundering across the sky, guided by, you know, whether it be a god of the dead or a leader of, you know, a ghost army kind of a thing. The Welsh might have called them Gwynep Nudd. Other cultures might have had Woden, or Hearn. Depending on where you went across Europe, there were different traditions associated with this wild hunt. And, you know, so, yeah, I mean, it's something to note.
Well,
now,
one of the things I also find really, really interesting is that Beltane and Samhain are the only two celebrations that Pilny mentions when he's writing about the Druids back in his actual writings. And it came over into some of the mythology. Oh, wonderful. Another call. Some of the mythology with crud, who did those? Cat move. Sorry. You don't need to be on the show. I can't remember the name of his of the guy's mythology. Oh, crud.
Are we talking about that dude from like the 19th century? Bullfinch?
Bullfinch, thank you. Oh my God, just drawing a complete blank on this one. I hate
that's
it when
okay.
that happens. Yeah, that's the only thing. Those are the only festivals mentioned in Bullfinch's mythology when he actually redoes the writings of Pilny at the time, talking about the Druids just before his section on Arthurian mythos, which I think it's kind of interesting. He talks about the Druids and then goes right to Arthur. So obviously, you know, that kind of shows how important those two festivals were to the Druids and to the Celtic people in general. I do know that there were, you know, some common themes. It was seen as a very transitional time of the year. So new things would happen at various parts. I think Buckland mentioned in the Big Blue Book at some point that not only was divination done at both of them, but it seems like the fertility rites for the herds, the domesticated herds, were done at Beltane, and the same fertility rites for the wild herds were done at Samhain. So there's that connection too, and it you know sort of shows that there's a real connection with all life and everything that's going on. Simply because, you know, during the winter you don't have a whole lot growing. You can't go out and get this herb from the garden because it's not growing at that point in time. There's 3 feet of snow on the ground. So, you know, you have to preserve it. And so at that point in time, you're dealing with not only the preservation, but the time when the sick are dying off in the herds. And so you can go out and grab their carcasses and drag them back to your cave and eat those. And, you know, you're having to depend on a lot of luck during the winter months. So I guess that's one of the reasons why they started inventing the god of the herds, like Cernunnos or Hearn, or various other deities along those lines, the horned gods, to, you know, sort of husband us and shepherd the worshipers through the winter months. You know, in modern society, we've gotten really away from that because we can go to the grocery store and pick up anything we want. But 200 years ago, you know, that wasn't the case. So, you know, you actually had to pay attention to the seasonal cycles and what was available and the preservation and everything like that. So I'm going to shut up now.
It's very true. And actually, speaking of divination, Joy, don't you offer tarot readings? Wouldn't Salon be a brilliant time?
Yeah, one of the things that we wound up talking about before the show is that I do tarot readings, and this is a common time since it's the beginning of the year. The Celts considered this to be the beginning of the year, and as such, I'd offer tarot readings. I got some trick-or-treaters. I'll be right back. Hang on.
Okay. Well, I suppose what I can do is probably play a short little tune for you guys. So what I'm actually going to do is play Sharon Knight and T. Thorne Coyle singing Prayer to the Dead. Okay, welcome back, folks. I wanted to play a song there so that Joy could come back from the trick-or-treaters and, you know, finish her mention of tarot.
Yeah, and it's not so much tarot is as much as one of the traditions for Samhain, because it is the new year, is divination for what's coming up, not only over the winter months, the dark half of the year, but also, you know, for what's going to go on in general, interpersonal relationships, things like that. And that's another one of the common themes that occurs both at Samhain and at Beltane, to, you know, find out what's coming up. So if you are interested in getting a tarot reading from me or somebody, you know, that you know, get in touch with them. I have a banner ad at magicalmusings.net. At the bottom, just click on it. It says Tarot by Davin. That'll take you to my website where we can, you know, set up the cost for it. I'll be more than happy to read for you. And usually that happens within at least a couple of days. So, you know, come there, give me money. I love you. And we'll get back to the show now.
Yeah, okay, so that being said, what I figured tonight we would do is to sort of step into the Christian influence that that, you know, brought Halloween to what it is nowadays. And I think it's something that a lot of people don't really realize, because you hear in a lot of the anti-Halloween propaganda that it's a season of the devil and it's a terrible thing and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But in truth, the early church, particularly under the Roman Empire, had a tendency to absorb pre-existing celebrations. This was shown in things like Pomona and Lemuria and, you know, various other celebrations that happened throughout, like, the fall and winter. Now, it obviously happened in Europe with the adoption by the church of Yule into Christmas, because ultimately the whole idea of the light coming into the world is a theme that you can trace back to multiple cultures. Now, at this time of year, there's, because of the fact that people connected death to this period in time, you have this tradition in the church that existed where they would celebrate something called All Saints, which in the original calendar for the Christian church, or at least the Catholic church, was somewhere in like May or June by our calendar. And because the cultures continued to celebrate, you know, their dead at this time of year, what they did was move that day to November 1st so that they could say, well, you know, you're celebrating, but this is the day that you're celebrating. You're celebrating all the saints that don't have their own feast days. Now, it was a sneaky way of them, you know, kind of not, you know, like slotting in their ceremony into what existed already. And you can see evidence of that in, like, South America, where you've got the Days of the Dead, you've got, like, a blend of the native and Catholic traditions into what is now, like, one of the biggest parties every year in South America. And you can see it even leaking up as far as, like, Vancouver, British Columbia, where they actually have parades celebrating the Day of the Dead. You got celebrations of the DOD, Dia de los Muertos, for those who want to be specific, sort of finding their way into Spanish populations in every major city, really. You've got places where artists are setting up altars so that people can tell their stories and leave offerings for their dead and that sort of thing. So it becomes a cultural experience that everyone can enjoy. Now, let's see. When you've got all these festivals coming together, you know, and then there was a period of time called, well, can't remember its specific name. I think it was the Reformation, where you've got a guy named Martin Luther, who in, like,
yeah, that was
Germany,
the Protestant Reformation.
Was it? Excellent.
That's what that was. Yeah.
who decides, he's like, I don't really like some of the stuff that the Catholic Church is doing, but I like some of the stuff that they are doing. So he tacks up onto his local church a list of, I believe it was 97 things that he found wrong with. Was it only 57?
Yeah, it was.
He tacks this up on the wall, and he's like, these are the things I find wrong with the Catholic Church. So people kind of read this, and they're like, wow, this is true. You know, this is kind of screwed up. So maybe we'll start our own church, you know, figure our own thing out, take away all this stuff that we don't like. And so you get the Lutheran expression of the Catholic tradition. So you get like Lutheranism, and, you know, in the British Isles, it was what we, you know, in Canada call Anglicanism, Episcopalianism, you know, it Church of England. It's got different names in different parts of the world. But the idea is that they've sort of retained certain aspects of the Catholic nature of the tradition while taking out some of the things that they didn't agree with. And in certain denominations, some of those traditions that they took out were like All Saints, the saints just as people in general, Christmas and so on. You've got like the emergence of the, oh God, what are they called again? Puritans, who, mm-hmm. you know, who are like so vehemently anti-Catholic. They're like, we don't celebrate Christmas. We don't celebrate, you know, All Saints, All Souls. We don't even acknowledge the saints, et cetera, et cetera. So they become kind of an early fundamentalist approach to Christianity, where it becomes this purist idea of what is truly right within Christianity. And naturally, because they've taken out the Halloween stuff, you know, they've taken all these other things out. And in an effort to sort of establish their own nation, where they had this so-called pure version of Christianity, you found them hopping aboard the Mayflower and sailing across the ocean to North America.
Well, where also, they figured, one of the things that...
Go ahead.
Understand something. The Puritans were so virulently against everything that Lutheranism at the time was espousing, that every country threw them out. It's not that they didn't like what was going on. It's that they couldn't, they were trying to get their beliefs into the societal structure that were so antithetical to what was being believed. They believed that there was, that women should shut up and that they had no right to vote. Well, they're talking about this in Holland, where women, you know, have perfect rights to not only vote, but speak up and hold public office. You know, and these people are going, you know, no, women are, you know, because of Eve, and they're terrible people, and they should be put down, and all of the society around them is going, up yours, and get the hell out of our country. And so that's what actually drove them onto the boats and across the sea, because they were trying to set up an ultra-fundamentalist religion that was all pervasive. They were actually trying to take a step back multiple centuries to what things used to be like, rather than dealing with things as they were. So just go ahead. I just wanted to interject that.
No worries. So, I mean, you've got the Puritans and their resistance of all things Catholic. So for a time, a celebration like All Hallows or All Saints dies away. You know, it doesn't make it to the New World. Now, come like the 19th century, you've got an influx of Irish immigrants who bring over Catholicism and a lot of traditions that relate to Samhain, like, you know, the sort of party games and divination and things like pumpkins or not pumpkins in that time, but the tradition of carving jack-o'-lanterns, which in Ireland prior to, you know, the shipment over of pumpkin seeds and stuff from the New World was actually turnips. Now, I don't know if anyone else has ever tried to cut a turnip, like, to use it in soup or whatever. Those little things are hard and unpleasant to work with. Now, imagine trying to make a hollowed-out turnip into a little face that you can put a light into. It's smaller, obviously. I don't know what it would smell like, to be honest. The idea just doesn't appeal to me to try. But you get, like, the tradition of the jack-o'-lantern, and you get other traditions that come over. Now, when they arrived in the New World, they found that this large, fleshy orange squash, the pumpkin, was easier to carve. And, you know, it was a versatile vegetable, fruit, whatever it is. And it was, because it was easier to carve, suddenly that was incorporated into the Halloween celebrations. Now, for the early part of the 19th century, what you got was kind of the enjoyment of party games and nights where people would gather to tell stories, ghost stories, you know. They would practice divination and so on. But in the later part of the 19th century, the Civil War broke out. And suddenly, because death was so prevalent, so common, and so real to them, Halloween didn't really appeal to a lot of people anymore because there was just so much death all the time. Now, it, you know, obviously lulled into a period, but following the Civil War, of course, it started finding its expression again. Suddenly there was, you know, the party games again, stories and things, because people were trying to grasp some joyful times following the war. And this kind of pattern has actually occurred more than once through the course of Halloween's history. You get into the 20th century, and prior to World War I, the same kind of thing happens. You know, there's party games and, you know, dances and storytelling and divination, and World War I breaks out, and suddenly, you know, it goes into like a quiet period where people are just not into it. And then following that war again, you've got the 20s and early 30s, and there's a period of time where Halloween becomes this cultural phenomenon where people are again enjoying the parties, but you also get the introduction of pranks. And, you know, in that period, there are people kind of they're building stuff on their neighbors' houses, or they're taking down gates so the neighbors' animals will run away, or, you know, I don't know. I grew up hearing about cow tipping, never done it because I didn't grow up in a rural area, but Loretta Lynn actually spoke about doing that when she was a kid. So, you know, apparently that's a very real thing.
Having grown up in enough of a suburb that we actually had cow pastures nearby, even though I didn't do any of this, cows, the myth on that one is that cows sleep with their legs locked, and that they will sleep an entire night standing up. And if you sneak up quietly, you can push them over, and that's called cow tipping. However, it's not true. They will doze like a horse does while standing up. However, in order to sleep deep enough that you can actually sneak up on them, they lay down. The ones that are standing up are probably not that deeply asleep, and you can't really push them over.
Interesting. That is fascinating, actually.
That is what cow tipping literally is. It is tipping a cow over.
Well, I remember that part, but it does strike me that you couldn't do that because I've never seen a sleeping cow standing up. Because even you go to like zoos and harvest festivals or agricultural fairs, and you see the cows lying on the ground, and you wonder why would they sleep standing up if they can do that.
Yeah, and that's one of those observable things that people in the country don't believe because it's not true, but people in urban areas are exceedingly gullible to something like that because they don't care to learn about rural areas, and what actually happens. So,
that's very true.
Yeah, we go cow tipping every night. It's lots of fun. And you can prank your city cousins with. It's like a snipe hunt.
That's funny. Yeah, I mean that's actually a really good point. Because you do hear about that all the time. Now. Let's see. World War II struck, of course, and naturally the enthusiasm for Halloween died out. Things were more important, like helping out with the war effort kind of thing. It was a very patriotic thing to do to, like, set aside all your fun for the war effort. So, kids, instead of going out trick-or-treating, would go out collecting, like, scrap metal or things like that that would help the soldiers overseas. Now, following WW2, what you end up with is that sort of baby boom time where, suddenly everything was good again and, the economy picked up and people were looking for ways to enjoy their lives. Halloween got popular again, and there were actually stores marketing costumes for kids, for Halloween. And there were treats being sold in the stores. And this was the first time that you'd actually see, like, treats wrapped in smaller portions for Halloween, or the idea of, in the early days, like probably in the 40s, say, costumes were actually made of paper. Now, what's wrong with putting a kid in a paper costume who's going out playing it with jack-o'-lanterns and candles and things? Well, paper burns. So do the children wearing paper. So suddenly they began to realize that paper costumes were not so safe. And they started using things like fabric and plastic, things that were a little less prone to burning. So, the history of Halloween costumes is, pretty interesting in itself. And, unfortunately, I remember the days back in the early 80s, I guess it was, when a, quote, costume consisted of basically a vinyl poncho. Or, I don't know, yeah, I guess you'd call it a poncho kind of a deal. Or, whatever, a vest. And then a plastic mask. And the thing you were wearing on your body had the cartoon of the mask that you were wearing. They were kind of cheesy looking, it was kind of like the easy way out for parents who didn't really want to do Halloween properly. So
who didn't have the money for it and the resources for it.
That too. Actually, it's interesting because that seems a very strange thing considering the fact that, way back when, early 20th century, you've got the tradition where people are just digging out old clothes of their parents or their grandparents or whatever, and going out as hobos and, clowns and stuff just based on what they could find around the house. Whereas, for some strange reason, in the 80s, maybe the 70s and 60s, don't know yet, wasn't alive in most of that era, you've got people buying these plastic and horrendously fragile masks. Like, you tapped them wrong and they just tore. And these poncho thingies, and sometimes there would be parents who would make costumes, and so on and so forth. But Halloween was still through the 60s and, you know, into the 70s, it was very much a kid's holiday. In the 70s and 80s and into the 90s, suddenly you see more and more ways for adults to enjoy Halloween again. Because as the kids from the 50s grew up, they had memories of celebrating Halloween as kids, and they wanted to bring that into their adult lives because, to be honest, Halloween is fun. So what they would do then is to host costume parties, dances, you know, parades, various events that adults could enjoy. Into the 80s and 90s, you see costumes getting sexier. So you've got like the sexy nurse costumes and that sort of thing.
It's much so more a reaction at that point. I mean, the massive consumerization is really started happening in the 80s, and people started cashing in on pop culture figures at that point. I mean, I can remember way back when I was little in the 70s. The costumes that were available then were, you know, cheesy things, like you said. Very much, if you've ever seen it's the Charlie Brown Halloween, where Lucy has the green witch mask and basically a drape. That's a lot of how they were happening. Late 70s, you had a pop culture phenomenon that just went berserk with Batman and Superman, and Star Wars came into the mix, and people started making money on movies and pop culture icons. And so then they started marketing things that were related to that. And then you had that explosion of a lot of costumes and everything. And it started becoming a big commercial holiday at that point in time, which led us, you know, through the 90s and the ooze up till now, where you have, you can't, you know, starting sometime in August, you can't really swing a dead cat any place without hitting five costumes of 50 different franchises of materials available, and, you know, everything from DC to Marvel to, I don't know, you know, and it just gets, it got ridiculous. And at some point in there, I think a lot of people lost interest in it because it did become so much of a cultural phenomenon and a commercial phenomenon. And the only people that were actually enjoying it were the manufacturers of the costumes and the candy manufacturers.
Yeah, I mean, for sure.
If you think about it, from about now till probably somewhere mid-March, the only people that are really going to be happy are the candy manufacturers, because you've got Halloween, then you've got Thanksgiving, then you've got Christmas, then you've got New Year's, then you've got Valentine's Day, then you've got St. Patrick's Day, all of which require candy. You know, so they're the only ones that are going to be really happy during this time of the year. And in my opinion, it's going to wind up being pushed back further and further and further until you're, you know, buying Christmas presents in July, literally.
It's true. Yeah, unfortunately, that kind of is a very realistic thing. And I, even nowadays, I mean, you get movie franchises that are geared toward the marketing they're going to do afterwards. So you've got the toy market for Thor. You know, I mean, I remember before I ever saw the movie that my brother-in-law had bought the hammer, the electronic hammer that made noises or some crap like that, because,
oh, yes,
you know, it was a Thor hammer. And I was like, really? You haven't even seen the movie and you bought the hammer already? But yeah, he was quite pleased with having bought it, and, you know, so be it. But, I mean, that seems to be the way of things with a lot of movie franchises nowadays. Even like before movies come out, when a series of books has hit it, you know, it has like hit the big time. You've got the related to movies or related to a hit movie, you know, release of various books. I remember happening with Harry Potter. You know, basically obscure
and then
titles.
The re-release. Yeah. Then there's the re-release of the same book that you bought that 5 years ago that now has all of the stars from the major motion picture on the cover instead of the original artwork. And, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you've seen that with the Lord of the Rings trilogy and The Hobbit.
The Hunger Games.
The Hunger Games. It's true. It's kind of sad. And you've got it with, with the Harry Potter books as well. But, yeah, I mean, you've got a culture, basically, that markets everything to new movies. Like, if they know that it's going to be a geared toward kids kind of a consumer good, they're going to market costumes for it. So, like, anything connected to a comic series, you're likely to get the movie, and then a string of costumes and candy and toys and this, that, and the other that are connected to it.
Breakfast cereals and cookies and soda pop and... Yeah, that's
it's true.
Okay, getting off of Halloween for just a little bit, and Salen, one of the things I think that irritates me the most is you've got tricks and... For example, or some sort of sugar cereal that has been marketed for years and years and years, and suddenly a new movie comes out, and now you're seeing it with the characters from that movie on the box. We had one guy that was at work where I worked at with Dell who collected the soda cans from the Avengers movie, and they were just Coke. But because it had seven different characters on the cans, he had to have them all. So he went out and bought cases of Coke just to get those seven cans. And it's like, why? You know, anyway, back to
the worst is
Salen.
When people have never, ever consumed that particular good, and then they just go out of their way to collect it because they want the set.
Mm.
Yeah, so, I mean, you've got, like, periods of time in which even costumes and Samhain itself are marketed toward consumption. Now, from there, you get into the modern pagan celebration, the general modern celebration of it. You've still got, like, Halloween, but because of various influences over the course of centuries, you've got similar holidays coming up that are coming up especially through the same three-day period, October 31st, November 1st, and 2nd, in like the tradition of voodoo, for instance, where there's a heavy Catholic influence, because in voodoo, you've got the Fete Gaidée, on November 2nd, which is their festival to acknowledge the Gaidée, who are the Loa, the voodoo spirits, I guess you could say, of sex and death. So again, you see that reflection of life and death balanced in the same period that you see at May Day. Where May Day, I guess, is more focused on the life focus with sex. You've got Samhain, which focuses on sort of a more death-balanced sex thing. And
which would make sense, given that it's going into a time when the days are shorter and when, you know, it's you're more dependent upon, instead of things growing, things dying, and getting your food and sustenance through that kind of stuff. So that would kind of make sense.
Well, and what I kind of noticed too, I think, is the fact that what you're doing too is kind of preparing your family for the winter, because if a man and a woman conceive a child at Samhain, then they're carrying it through as a, you know, small being, you know, a fetus, etc., up into the spring or summer, when it'll be healthy and there's going to be plenty of food for the mom to be able to produce milk to make the baby healthy, etc. So it seems like connecting sex with Samhain is a very sensible idea when you're dealing with that, you know, seasonal abundance and scarcity cycle.
Well, and if you look at it from just a practical standpoint, a human being can do without food as long as they're warm. So as long as you've got a lot of firewood and a source of heat, you know, you can do with a reduced amount of food. So what's something that you can start doing when you start running short, you know, sometime in December of things to eat? Well, you cuddle up with your beloved, you know, and if you're like most red-blooded human beings, if you're cuddling close and you don't have very many clothes on under, you know, 12 layers of blanket, things are going to get a little hot and heavy at that point, and, you know, the hormones are going to start working, and of course it's going to be natural to, you know, have sex, and that generates heat. So it's, you know, a practical standpoint too.
This is true. This is very true. This is a very good point.
You know,
now,
and it's dark
see.
For most of the day. 18 hours, there's no sunlight. And, you know, the few hours that you've got sunlight, you go out and collect firewood, you bring it back, and, well, you don't have anything else to do. So let's cuddle under the blankets, okay?
Yes, you're rushing around gathering firewood and eating, and then the rest of the time you're just screwing around.
This is what happens. This is, you know,
go ahead.
No, it's just, you know, I'm thinking of something, you know, 2,000 years ago, and I can understand why some of the things started developing, because when you think about that time period, you didn't have stores, you didn't have major metropolises. You were lucky if you had a village of a dozen people, and they grew up, you know, around the forge and the communal water area, the well or whatever it was. But the outlying farms, you know, they're having to be self-sufficient. They can only get into town once every month, maybe. And so, yeah, it was a very practical, very centric, very isolated kind of living. You took care of the stuff when you could. You tried not to burn your candles because they were expensive, you know, and they weren't something that you came across all the time. So the fire in the fireplace was what you had. And, yeah, so you spend 10, 12, 15 hours under the covers, you know, and when you got tired of laying down, you got up and sat in a chair all wrapped up in one of the blankets. And you did whittling on a comb, or making new utensils out of wood, spinning thread, carting out the wool that you harvested a few months ago. You know, because that's the type of thing, those are the types of craft things that you can do over the winter months to fill the time. You didn't have books. You didn't have television. Most of the populace was illiterate. So you did maintenance things over the winter. You didn't have time to repair your boots in the middle of summer because you're getting up at, you know, 4 in the morning, having a bite to eat, getting out, milking the cows, planting the crops, weeding the crops, going out and doing this and fetching this and grabbing this and hunting that and dragging it back and killing this and preserving
this.
Yeah,
basically.
And then you fall into bed, you know, at 11 o'clock. So you don't have time to fix your boots. So you do that during the winter when you're sitting there with nothing else to do.
Yeah, definitely. And, I mean, realistically, it makes sense that, you know, when you're indoors most of the time, that's when you're doing all your repair work and your maintenance of things. You there?
You know. Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay.
And
okay.
You know,
my headset is all screwed up. So.
Oh, it's all right. It's still reflected in a lot of what happens on a farm today.
Yeah.
Typically,
well, definitely.
You know, right around fall is when they start preserving everything. You know, and that's a lot of work, and you're indoors and it's hot, but the days outside are cooling down. You know, now there's some of the slaughtering of some of the animals, and there's making certain things that you do during the winter months, like head cheese, putting up preserves and wines and things along those lines, you know, and maybe thinking about going out ice fishing, you know, in December and stuff. So, you know, that's all going on now, too. You know, we don't see it in an urban setting, but
that's
you know, that's what you live with out there.
And that, I mean, that does lead certain pagans to kind of move away from the agrarian cycle that you see sort of reflected in the standard Wiccan ritual year. Because there are a lot of urban folks who just don't feel that it's valid or relevant to their lives to follow an agrarian cycle. But at the same time, I think even in the heart of the city, you do experience to some degree the cycle of seasons, particularly you know, the farther north you go. I mean, you know, you go into like North America, you go into like Europe, you're experiencing seasons, and I mean it's basically unavoidable. So I mean, even in the heart of a city, you're going to feel fall, you're going to feel winter, you're going to feel, you know, summer, and you know,
yeah,
anyone
you
who
can
lives
feel fall. You can feel fall in like New York City, but it's a very, very different flavor than if you went to New Hampshire and looked at the maple syrup being harvested out of the maple trees. You know, and it would still be very different if you went to Vancouver or if you went up to Nome, Alaska, or went even further into, you know, a small town in very, very rural Yukon or Alaska, where, you know, it's not uncommon to see a moose come walking through the town during
That's
the
true.
Winter, even during the summer, you know. So it, you can feel it, but it's going to be very distant. It's not until you start getting out into the country that you actually start getting it immediate in your face. I mean,
yeah,
I have
definitely.
To make an effort to remember the moon phase. Because, I mean, as Wiccans, we're supposed to celebrate the moon phases, and I have to make an effort for it. Well, if I go stay with my cousins out in the farm area in Illinois, you know, that becomes very immediate. And believe me, the nights are much, much darker up there because they don't have all the ground light to, you know, light everything up. I'm sorry, we're getting off track
here.
That's
very true. But, I mean, that's a very valid point, and I think it's one that, you know, it does explain why people adhere to the cycle that's represented in the pagan wheel of the year, which incidentally was hammered together kind of in the 50s by Ross Nichols and Gerald Gardner, who were friends. They were both authors. They were, you know, kind of scholars and, you know, learned men, and it's what you see today. It's a nice sort of sensible approach to the cycle of the seasons, to the varying festivals that were practiced in European cultures, and I mean, getting to that point too, I mean, you'll hear different people say that Samhain is the Celtic New Year. There are different scholars who have opinions that contradict that, but the general feeling nowadays among pagans is that, you know, Samhain is kind of the new year. Because it's seen as a period of 3 days which are outside of time. They're not part of the regular cycle of days that make up a year. It's kind of a point where time stands still. This is why the veil is seen as thin. So that this is, you know, the time to connect with your ancestors and so on. Primarily because this is a time outside of time.
Well, and we've been talking about, you know, honoring your ancestors and honoring the dead. This is from a Wiccan standpoint, and I'm going to talk as my priestess self. This is, you know, the transition between the summer and the winter. When you think about the solstices, okay, the longest days and longest nights of the year, you've got Yule and you've got the one directly opposite. I believe that's Mabon, but I have to pull up the wheel of the year to make sure.
God.
No, it's not. Okay, Yule is the, I know Yule is the shortest day of the year. And a lot of Wiccans these days see that as the beginning of the new year, okay, because the sun is in the sky the shortest amount of time in the northern hemisphere, and then when you, 2 or 3 days later, when the days are actually getting measurably longer, you have the celebration because the sun is coming back. Well, that's, you know, you need time to get people together and to figure out, okay, you're going there and you're doing this and you're getting this. So right around the first is when you're actually celebrating the time of the sun is returning. And that's why they, I think that got grabbed for New Year. When you look at it from a Wiccan perspective, you can definitely divide the year into the light half of the year and the dark half of the year. Okay, and even though the shortest day of the year is Yule, which puts that in the time now, in the dark half of the year, the days start getting measurably, noticeably shorter from about now until Yule. That's mm-hmm. when you actually, you know, look in the sky and go, wow, it's darker now than it was 2 days ago. This is odd. And so this became the dark half of the year, the time period when the sun is going away, and now it's time to work to preserve things. And then because the sun is coming back after Yule, that's still considered the dark half of the year. There's still snow on the ground. It's still cold. The sun coming back hasn't started having an effect on the earth yet, because even though the days are getting longer, it's not getting warmer. It doesn't start getting warmer until somewhere around January 31st or so, which is another major holiday. And
yeah, definitely.
That's when, you know, and then you get over into Beltane when you have that transition from dark half to light half, and there's sunlight more often in the sky during the light half of the year, and I guess we'll discuss that when we talk about Beltane, on Beltane.
Indeed.
But, yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, the cycle of the festivals on the Wheel of the Year is a very logical progression. Is the point that we're trying to get to. Now,
it may not be ancient. It may not be something that was passed down from, you know, ancient times, but it is observable, and it is something that you can point to and go, okay, here is the reason that this is here. And that was one of the big questions that I always had. Who, you know, you have the solstices and the equinoxes, which are definite astronomical events. that you can look at.
They're undisputable. They
always happen right around here. Well, who decided that Samhain is October the 31st and that Beltane is May 1st? And because there's no astronomical event really for those days.
Well, exactly. The common tradition, too, it depends on your tradition, but some people just stick to, like, Candlemas or Halloween or, whatever the other two are. I can't think of them right now. But there are some people who actually spend the time counting the days that go from the winter solstice to the fall equinox, and they count down to the very center day between them, and that, for them, is Samhain. It's something that you can do. It's not mandated. It's not, something you're going to be punished for doing or not doing. But you will see some people get very particular about that. Some people like to celebrate it on the full moon nearest Halloween. It's all a matter of personal preference. Because what are called the cross-quarter days are not fixed in time. So you can basically put them where you feel like putting them.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm looking for my Wheel of the Year here. I feel stupid for not knowing it right off the top of my head.
Well, the opposite festival for Yule would be the summer solstice. So Litha, I guess, is the name some people call it by.
I believe so.
There's actually books. There's one called The Celtic Year or something like that. It's a book that I've read more than once, but basically he divides the year based on summer and winter solstices. Once we get to Yule, we're going to be talking about like the whole dividing the year based on the solstices, and we're going to be talking about all kinds of crazy different traditions. Because Christmas is only one expression of the solstice, but you cover all kinds of crazy stuff with that. But actually, one of the things I was hoping that Joy would discuss tonight was the Dumb Supper practice connected to Samhain.
That's one of the things that you got to understand. There's a number of different events that happen on Samhain. There is the thinning of the veils between the worlds. There is the start of the new year. There's the harvest. There's the fertility of the herds. As part of the honoring the ancestors, there's a tradition in a lot of pagan celebrations called the Dumb Supper, which is essentially you sit down to a feast. It's the same feast that you would have with the harvest, but instead of setting 10 places for your family, you set 11. And you serve the empty space too. And it's understood that empty space is where your ancestors are at. Because I don't know about you guys, but, my grandma and grandpa and cousins are a bunch of gossipy people. They love to know what's going on with the family. They love being involved in things that are happening. They love to know who's had a baby, what this person is doing as their job, how this other kid is doing in school. And that doesn't go away after you die. And it's a way to get your family involved, the deceased family involved back in your life again. You just sit around the table. You have a meal. You talk about your lives. You talk about your plans. You don't have to address dead grandma, the empty place, but you don't censor yourself on talking about these things because that gives your ancestors a chance to also participate and hear what's going on and what's happening. I'm sorry, my cats are freaking out here. We've got storms in the area, and I didn't expect that we were going to have any trick-or-treaters tonight, but the cats are scared of all the wind and everything, which I think is very appropriate and very elemental for right now.
Yes.
But yeah, the Dumb Supper is a wonderful tradition because you can get your deceased relatives involved in your family still. And they're still an immediate part of your family. I mean, just because they're dead doesn't mean that they stopped being your parents or your grandparents, you know, because they're still
exactly.
there. And you can remember them. You can wake them again. It's a time to also remember their lives again. One of the traditions in a lot of the pagan Wiccan celebrations for Samhain celebration is to remember the dead of the year. I mean, I don't know how many people watch the Oscars every year or the Emmys, but they have a segment in there where they'll go through and they'll, you know, remember the actors and the actresses that have died during that year since the last one. That's something that you do at Samhain as well. You know, you just go through and you remember your beloved dead and remember them. You honor them. You talk about them. You remember what they did, what they didn't do, what you felt like, how they made you feel, and make them a presence in your life again. You know?
Yes. Good shit. Now... now that we've talked over the sort of modern and specifically pagan celebrations, something I want to do before I start the visualization exercise that we're going to be doing later is to talk about the modern anti-Halloween movement. A lot of you will have heard about this as Jesusween. Now... obviously, it comes from sort of the more fundamentalist traditions of Christianity, with particular biblical passages criticizing the whole idea of consulting with people who use mediums or who have familiar spirits or, you know, various and sundry other criticisms that they have. You know,
which I always found bogus anyway.
Well,
I mean, because
exactly.
Here you have a king that rules against all the people that do divining and do the familiars, and yet in the same breath he goes and consults with a lady that does. You know,
well,
so it's
exactly.
like, wait a minute.
But I mean, that whole thing is it. I mean, you look into the Bible and you're talking about. I mean, one of the biggest ones that they panic over is the so-called Witch of Endor. Now. In the Bible, she's not a witch. She's a woman who happens to consult a spirit. I suppose technically that would make her a medium, but, you know, the outright statement that she's a witch based on that is exaggeration, let's say. But there's actually something I kind of wanted to play for you guys because it makes me laugh every time I hear it because it is just so paranoid and weird. And then I'll play that and then we'll get back to talking about Jesusween and, you know, various other sort of anti-Halloween traditions, I guess you could say. So, It'll be weird, folks. Bear with me. I enjoy it. You may not. You don't have to listen to it. You can mute it and go get a drink or something. But here it is.
Once a year, on a spooky night, Young boys and ghouls in ghoulish disguise. They cover the skin, conceal their eyes.
A great mistake to be out when the ghosts are about. It's Halloween.
A time to be on the rest of the world. They don't observe this ash which has become our biggest concern.
repel them.
All right, folks. I cut that off 20 seconds early because it doesn't really get into much after that. But, yeah, I mean, basically, you've got that. I think I found it on YouTube when I, you know, discovered it originally. And you've got a lot of the sort of classic anti-Halloween remarks. I think the last 20 seconds were probably sort of a religious promotion of, you know, go to your church and escape the evil of Halloween kind of deal.
Certainly paranoid.
Well, yes.
My
That's the thing. Yes. And that was one of the things that made me laugh so much the first time I heard that because, you know, you've got this criticism of Ouija boards. And again, like we've said in past episodes, Ouija boards are a novelty. They're not, you know, dangerous. They won't open the gateways to hell. They're fun, you know.
Just goes to show how paranoid some people are.
Well, exactly, but I think
Sorry.
without the exaggeration of that paranoia, I mean, you don't get movements that, you know, counter Halloween. I mean, in the milder cases, you see the celebrations of not Halloween, but harvest festivals and that sort of thing that, you know, tone down the elements of, quote, evil in Halloween. But at the same time, you know, there's also the hyper-exaggeration of, quote, countering the evil by promoting Jesus as a solution to that. So you get something, which I only heard about, I think, last year or maybe the year before, called Jesusween. And there's actually a website, jesusween.com, because I haven't looked at it in forever. But,
thank God.
You know, it talks about exactly that. And it's like the idea of churches going out and missioning in their neighborhoods. Instead of handing out candy, you know, you hand out like Bibles or tracts or this, that, or the other. And it's just, it's like, what is the point then of doing that? I mean,
well, understand something. Christianity is based on, I hate to say this, but when you look at it anthropologically, this is true. Christianity is a death cult. Everything good that happens to you after you die. Everything
That's
bad
true.
That happens to you happens after you die. You're rewarded or punished after you die. And it's not anything that you do here and now. You're not allowed to, you know, enjoy now. You have to wait until after you're dead to get your rewards.
Well,
so
exactly.
People come to – so the mindset brings along a fear of death and a fear of punishment after you're dead. So in a celebration that honors the dead and honors the spirits and, you know, is a way of bringing back the dead and saying, hi, how are you, Grandma? Here's what's going on in my life. You know, that becomes something to be scared of.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, it's unfortunate that a death cult has to crap on a day that's dedicated to honoring the dead because it seems somewhat a contradiction in terms to shit on people who acknowledge their passed on relatives by telling them to praise and accept a prophet, basically, who died and came back. Now, yeah,
they
so,
never
I mean,
really think about that.
Well, no, because they're only given a, you know, a kind of watered down version of the story, right? A lot of them don't actually read the Bible. You know, they don't actually see things as they're written. They only go by what they're told. And it's especially handy if the population, as it would have been in the Middle Ages and earlier, you know, doesn't actually know how to read, right? This is where you get, like, leaders who can manipulate churches in poor neighborhoods to believe the craziest shit. And it's because, you know, people don't read the word for themselves that they just take what they're told as truth. This goes back to
not having the time to do anything. You've got only so many hours in the day, and with an illiterate populace, they don't have time to sit down and actually pray. I actually heard at one point a priest's job is to spend the hours on their knees praying for the people that don't have the time to do it for themselves. That's what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to read the words, and they're supposed to, you know, teach what those words are, not teach an interpretation of them. And so that's what the religion is supposed to do. What it actually winds up doing is giving a shortcut to people who are too lazy to actually do some of the work for themselves.
That's very true. If
you go to church and you're told what to believe, then you don't have to figure it out on your own.
That's so true. Yeah. And I mean, I think that's kind of where the whole phenomenon of hell houses has come about too. Because rather than have people read the Bible and discover, well, this is crazy, you know, instead you've got a lot of churches, quote, celebrating Halloween by operating, instead of haunted houses, what are called hell houses, which are these kind of theatrical productions designed to scare people into believing in Jesus Christ and the message of the church. So you've got, like, in the more popular script that I'm aware of, you've got, like, things like gay marriage, but, like, the devil talks about it in terms of being evil and all this other nonsense. You've got, like, abortion, but it's, like, a graphically violent, disturbing sort of depiction of the process, you know, basically like coat hangers and that sort of thing. It's like the scary old version of abortion that, you know, people used to keep to themselves and, you know, hope they didn't bleed out because they'd done it. You know, and it's all this exaggerated violence and gore that, you know, is meant to scare people away from, quote, hell and toward the, quote, light of Jesus Christ. Personally, that wouldn't have worked for me. I would have been like, wow, this is fucked up.
Well, don't forget also that, you know, it's designed by people that are scared of something to scare others. And
that's true.
It's supposed to be something that is not good, and it's supposed to make others fearful.
That's,
you know,
so true.
And this goes back to it being a death cult. I mean, if one person's scared of something, then everybody's got to be scared of it. Well, here
Absolutely.
You go with Not My Kink.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, just because you believe this way doesn't mean that I have to believe this way. And I saw Something Positive did a series on one of the hell houses not too long ago. Actually, several years ago, that I read that was just wonderful. Old man, one of the characters, goes into one of these hell houses, and the only way that they'll let you out of the house is if you accept Jesus as your savior and repent your sins. Well, he's like,
wow,
no, I'm not doing that. This is stupid.
Nuts.
You know,
so
they wouldn't let him out, and he refused to leave. So he sat down where he was at, and, you know, in the middle of a haunted house, they're trying to scare all these people, and he's just, you know, sitting there glaring at these guys.
That's
Finally, the
hilarious.
Cops are called. It was great. Finally, the cops are called, and they're like, you've got a 68-year-old man with Alzheimer's sitting here simply because you don't want to let him out and shut the place down.
That's just
his
weird.
His thing was, and, well, some of the other people that were coming through, you know, and were, what's he doing sitting there, joined him, and as they're leaving, they're like, you know, this is great. I had a really good time. And he's like, yeah, church wasn't like this when I was young. And the kid is like, wait a minute, you're Christian? And he said, yeah. And they're like, I've never encountered Christians that acted like you before. Which is a very, very sad commentary.
Well, yes.
When
I
you
mean,
stop and
again,
think about it.
Scare tactics make it so easy. Okay, so what I think we're going to do for the next 18 minutes is I'm going to play the little shape-shifting visualization that I have. Just because I went to the trouble of writing and recording it. So what we'll do when we come back from that is we'll offer our closing comments. Hope you guys enjoy this. I've had pretty damn decent success with a full moon guided visualization that I did last year sometime, which basically is like the most popular thing that's on Woodwost Radio. So give this a listen. If you don't like it, if you love it, email me, brian@magicalmusings.net. Don't harass Joy about it. She had nothing to do with it. So if, yeah, you want to shit on me for this not working, tell me. And I'm going to hit play right now, and then Joy and I are going to go hang out in a little room and wait for it to finish. So enjoy.
Comfortably. Breathe naturally. Close your eyes and imagine yourself full moon and a starry sky. Feel the cool night air on your skin. Feel the moon's glow. Warming your skin and filling your body. The moon's light fills your body like water filling a jug. Feel yourself warmer and filled with the moon's light. The light reaches the top of your head and continues to fill you. You feel the pressure within you. So much that your ears begin to hum and still the moon's light fills you. Skin feels as though it's crawling with thousands of worms crawling under your skin. It feels as though it's stretching, swelling, no longer suited to fit your body. You notice that your sense of smell has improved. You can smell the grass beneath you, the trees around you. You can smell things in the forest that you can't see. Yet they are, and you feel drawn to investigate. Your senses seem heightened. Your sense of touch, jaded. your skin begins to tear, but underneath, not bare flesh, but hair-covered skin, and a larger, stronger, taller body within it. As your human skin falls away, a new skin, a wolf skin, emerges. In your mind's eye, you see yourself standing taller, feeling stronger than you've ever felt before. In the moon's light, there is an instinct within you to raise your face to hers, to soak in the light she gives, to feel a mother's caress on your cheek, and from within you, a howl rises, and you let it out, praising your mother, the giver of this gift of transformation. Feel yourself in this body rise and begin to run into the forest faster, more agile than you've ever felt before. You find yourself able to leap and climb amid the branches, bouncing from tree to tree, climbing, tearing through obstacles, running faster than you've ever run before. Savor this strength, this speed. Savor your senses. Let them tell you about the world around you. Let them show you what the forest is to the eyes, ears, nose, and touch of a wolf. Give yourself some time to experience the world. Seek out the smells that you noticed before. Experience life while the beast within you emerges in this transformation. That there is a part of you still holding on to humanity. There are parts of you that seek to hunt, parts of you which are fearful. Explore these feelings within you. Discover both the animal nature and the limited and fearful human nature that holds you back. See if you can't, just for a while, of that human nature, so that in your experience you have the full effect of your wolf form. Things your human side fears. And know that this is the way of the wall. All the experiences as you run and climb and jump and howl in this new form. When you're ready, find your way back to the clearing where we started. When you get to the clearing, offer another howl to the moon. Thank her for the gift of this transformation. Find yourself seated on the ground, on your wolf haunches, and breathe. Bring yourself to a normal breathing rate. Find yourself feeling calm. Watch as the sky above you changes. Watch the moon sets as the stars twinkle in a moonless sky. And then to the east, watch as the sky turns pink and becomes yellow. The sun is rising. Warming. Brightening. Feel the sun's light warming your wolf form. Filling you with its light. Filling you with a sense of calm, a sense of normalcy. And when the sun's light has filled you, feel the light draining away beneath you into the earth. As the light flows away, you feel your wolf form shrinking, the hair disappearing, your senses becoming familiar, human. There's nothing to fear in this sensation. It's a scent turning of familiarity. When the light is gone, you are once again your human self. Animal nature within you. Take joy in that. And when you're ready, open your physical eyes and return fully conscious, fully yourself, to your day-to-day life. And know that you can return to that clearing, to that moonlit night, anytime you wish to experience for as long as you wish the freedom, the strength, and the power animal shapes, other media, become a fish, swim through the rivers and the sea, become a bird and fly through the air, become a cheetah and run as fast as you possibly can, become smaller animals and larger, a whale, a mouse. Know that transformation is a skill you can develop and master so that you can change your perspective on this your life.
Hi, folks. I hope you enjoyed that. We want to thank you for joining us tonight, this Samhain Eve. I know I've got
a ritual
to do later. I'm sure we could have done a couple of shows talking about different stuff related.
Oh, probably. Yeah, I've had fun listening and thinking about all of this, and, you know, there's always a ritual that you can do for anything. And it's fascinating to actually look at the various whys and wherefores. And
Absolutely. This
is a good show, I think. Mm-hmm. Anyway,
I hope
next week we're going to be talking about male and female dynamics in paganism. That I've just as we came up with the topic name and title, I've thought of about 20 different things that need to be touched on with that. So it shouldn't be too much of a problem to fill 2 hours with it. And it is, you know, something that needs to be talked about, because it is becoming more and more of a deal as Western civilization moves along. You can't really look at paganism as just for males and females anymore. You actually have to start thinking about in the dynamics of it's a fertility religion, and it's great to – or okay, there's several that are fertility religions – and it's great to look at it in terms of having babies and the growing of the crops and stuff. But you've got to start thinking about it in other terms, because time progresses, as Brian mentioned. Things change, and you start getting gay clergy, and, you know, that's what we're going to be talking about next week. So hopefully y'all will be tuning in and listening to it. Don't forget, I do tarot readings, so if you do want a New Year tarot reading or divination, go to the website at magicalmusings.net, click on the banner ad at the bottom to Tarot by Davin, and I'll be happy to do one for you.
And folks, Joy is pretty accurate and not prone to being soft-handed about it. There won't be a lot of dodging the little difficulty issues. You'll get the reading that you're meant to get. You know, there will be some readers out there who will soften it. Yeah, exactly. Sometimes you'll get readings that are like geared toward just the positive. You know, you don't want that. That's not realistic. Joy is not like that. A reading from Joy is going to be like, you're going to die. There's cancer a week from now in your future. This is just how it is.
God,
so go to your doctor.
Well,
I mean, okay, not that directly, but seriously, folks, if you want an accurate reading that's blunt and, you know, straightforward, talk to Joy about it. Thank you again for joining us tonight. Happy Samhain. Happy Halloween.
Be safe.
Happy Fête Gay Day. you know, be safe. Enjoy yourselves tonight. Don't do anything we wouldn't do that we would get caught for. Good night.
Talk to y'all later. See you next week.
Bye-bye. Good night.